The perfect combination of versatile athleisure and training apparel has arrived. Thanks to the visionary minds of New Balance, Clutch Athletics, and Rich Paul, the designs reflect the heart of the athlete and the spirit of the community. With rising defensive football stars Will Anderson and Chase Young on the roster, Clutch Athletics brings the best innovative gear to all athletes, giving them style and performance on and off the field. Learn more and purchase Clutch Athletics at NewBalance.com.
Welcome to the Cover 3 Podcast with your hosts, Chip Patterson and Barton Simmons. It's your call for the best college football coverage. From National Signing Day to the National Championship and everything in between, CBS Sports presents the Cover 3 Podcast.
And welcome back to the Cover 3 Podcast here on CBS Sports. That's Tom Fornelli. I'm Chip Patterson. It's Saturday night. We've still got Washington in action, Boise State in action, Wyoming, San Diego State with just a beautiful 14-6 game about a third of the way through the third quarter. Tom, we are lacking Barton Simmons. Do you want to give him a call right now? It's about 12:27 on the East Coast, and I know he's in Charleston. Do you think that he and his wife would like that?
I figure that at the moment, Barton is on a dance floor making somebody's aunt feel young again right now. So I don't know if we should call.
Any weddings during football season? Do you have strong takes? The internet has strong takes. Do you?
I pretend I do. I don't. I will say that I've had some cousins get married during football season, and I have not gone to their weddings. And it's not because I don't love my cousins. It's that in this job, there are about 14 days a year where I feel like, you know, are like the important days. And I just feel like I need to show up for them. So, I mean, you know, like there was all that talk this week. I don't know if you heard about it, but like the Diamondbacks pitcher Daniel Hudson missing the first game of a playoff series because his kid was being born and people were giving him crap about it. But not quite that kind of same situation. And I feel like, you know, my cousins, when they get married, they're still going to be my cousins. I'll still meet them. I'll still meet the new family. You know, we'll get to know each other later. So I don't think missing a wedding is the biggest deal.
I've been to two weddings. I've gotten off work for two weddings that I've been in, and I've missed a lot of weddings, and it makes me sad, but I don't hold it against them. I mean, it's their wedding, right? I mean, it's not my party. We already got to experience that. So that's
the thing.
That's good.
Like, unless it's like an immediate close relative or a close friend, it's not like somebody's going to be like, yeah, I mean, my wedding's okay, but it would have been a lot better if Chip was there.
Well, they always, you know what I mean? Say that. All right, but I hope Barton had fun, and he will be back, of course, on Monday for Monday's show to offer whatever takes he had. In terms of our locks, I guess our lock Unity took its a loss, right? Second loss of the season.
Yeah, we went 2-1 today in Lock Unities.
2-1 in Lock Unities, so plenty to celebrate right there. We'll begin with LSU Florida, where the final score was indeed an LSU cover, but the way that it broke down, I think that we've got a lot to look at Florida for, but then also an adjustment on LSU. Kind of one of those games where you embrace the nature of it being a top 10 SEC battle at night in Tiger Stadium, and you credit Florida for showing up while also kind of getting a good feel for LSU being able to take a hit and then be able to respond. Down 28-21, the defense only allows 7 points in the second half and gets a couple stops in the red zone. And so even though I think there are many nits to pick from the Tigers' performance, I come away feeling like LSU just in the pass-fail sense, definitely passed, and maybe even gets to get some really big check marks for its win against the Gators.
Yeah, I mean, this proved to me that, like, I've talked about it before. I wrote about it a few weeks ago. I talked about it on here where how I felt that LSU is the biggest threat to Alabama and the SEC, and tonight just kind of drove that point home for me because everything that Florida had to deal with and that we saw from LSU is why I think that they're a threat to Alabama. And we'll get to Georgia in a little bit, but I feel like when you combine what happened with the Bulldogs earlier on Saturday and seeing how LSU handled Florida tonight, it just kind of drove that point home even further for me, because this is a team that can score points on anybody. They put up 42 points and over 500 yards. They averaged 10.6 yards per play against a Florida defense that is very good, a Florida defense that essentially shut Auburn down last week. And if you look at Alabama, you know, that's a team that's scoring 50 points a game. It's not like it was, you know, however many years ago. You can't beat Alabama 9-6. You're going to need to score 40 points at a minimum to beat it. And if you look around at the SEC right now, LSU strikes me as the only offense in the conference that's capable of doing that. And I think that's the kind of sense you got tonight. And at the same time, I'm impressed with Florida, even though they lost, man.
Yes, they looked really good.
Kyle Trask played really well tonight. He had the interception in the end zone that kind of served as, you know, the killer. But Trask, after dealing with that, getting the sprained MCL last week against Auburn, going on the road to play LSU at night in Tiger Stadium, and he was completely calm, composed. He was throwing the ball well. He had over 300 yards, 3 touchdowns. He was able to run. They were doing like read options with him. What was driving me insane was Dan Mullen kept insisting on putting Emory Jones in like these key situations. And I'm like, listen, if Trask is struggling, okay. But I don't know why you're taking him out in these key situations for Emory Jones, and it's making your offense incredibly predictable. Like, as soon as Jones would come in, LSU said, okay, let's put 9 guys in the box. Let's see if he could beat us with his arm. And for the most part, he couldn't. He completed, you know, he was 1 for 2. He only threw 2 passes, but it was mostly a kind of QB run game, and LSU did a very good job of stopping it. So other than that, but overall, like I said, I was still very impressed by what the Gators did tonight, even though they lost by 14.
So you're saying you are not a fan of Dan Mullen trying to catch 2006 vibes with Trask as his Chris Leak and Emory Jones as his Tim Tebow?
No, and I mean, Emory Jones is very talented and is probably going to win quite a few games for the Gators in his career. But I just don't think tonight, I feel like it was a situation where he prepared this week thinking, hey, you know, maybe my QB, Kyle Trask, is going to have some problems and we're going to have a plan B. We're going to have a counterpunch. And then Trask came out and played really well, but he still felt like, well, we prepared for it. We have to use it. And it was just, it was like, I think he maybe should have just called an audible and let Trask do what Trask was doing, because Kyle was cooking, man. He was playing really well. And I thought, I mean, for the first half, Trask and Joe Burrow were trading blow for blow. You know, they were marching up and down the field. Both offenses were scoring quickly. And it was, you know, very much a shootout-y game. And I thought Trask was fantastic. And I think that, you know, I think Trask is a much better fit for Florida going forward than Felipe Franks was, simply because while Franks is talented, he takes a lot of chances that you really don't want your QB taking. And I feel like Trask has just as much talent as Franks does, but he's a little smarter with his decisions and he's not doing it. He's not taking those crazy risks. He takes the smarter risks. So I think he's better for their ceiling going forward. And it's just, this was just a great game. I mean, that's really my biggest takeaway. It's like, it was a matchup of 2 teams in the top 10 with a lot of hype that actually lived up to the hype. And it was a lot of fun to watch at the same time. It's like, okay, I will take like 4 or 5 more games just like this, please.
So LSU makes some defensive adjustments. They start bringing a little bit more pressure, leaving their cornerbacks and their defensive backs out and man free, kind of putting them out there to go make plays. Derek Stingley, who had been picked on and gave up some balls earlier, comes up with the big play that you mentioned down near the end of the game. LSU's defense in the first half was among the conversation, a little bit of the criticism. Again, if there are nits to pick with LSU's performance, do you see LSU's defense as big picture, when you look at the team, something to be concerned about? Or is it one where you can excuse it just based on the nature of the game?
I'm not super concerned about it, because this isn't a situation like we saw last year with Oklahoma where it was, you couldn't rely on Oklahoma's defense to get a stop. LSU's defense can get stops. It's a very talented team. It has a very talented defensive line. It's got good linebackers, and it has a bunch of NFL players in its secondary. So I'm not concerned about it. I think this is just a situation where if you think about what the narrative was in the SEC for so long, it was just, you know, our defense, we play defense in the SEC, blah, blah, blah. Well, it's also because you didn't have a lot of great offenses in your conference, which helps make your defenses look better. And you run into a situation where you look in the NFL now, too. You've got elite players on every defense in the NFL. But guess what? The offenses are still winning every single week. And the SEC is kind of approaching that situation with Alabama and LSU now, where even if you have elite players and elite talent, if you're going up against an offense that is schemed well and has plenty of talent itself, the offense is going to win out more often than not in the long run. So when I look at LSU and I look at them, if I'm comparing them to Alabama, I'm not as worried about their defense because, A, like I said, they've got plenty of talent and they've shown they can get stops. And, B, it's not like Alabama's got a shutdown defense either. So, no, it's not a huge concern to me. If you could score 50 points a game, your defense doesn't become that much of a problem as long as it's not allowing 30 points per game. And that's not what LSU's doing.
You did have the live blog for that game in Baton Rouge. Any other major takeaways that stood out or interesting nuggets or facts during your work?
I think it's kind of scary. The scariest thing for me, if I'm anybody in the SEC tonight, is that the one thing that LSU hadn't been doing a great job of on offense was running the ball. Like, I think they were averaging like 4.2 yards per carry, which is pretty mediocre. Tonight, they averaged 9.1 yards per carry against Florida. You know what I mean? A Florida defense that's been top 20 in the country in run defense this year. So if all of a sudden LSU has found a run game to pair with what Joe Burrow and those receivers have been able to do all season long, good luck.
How about this? Florida entered the game number 2 in the country in sacks, 0 sacks against LSU. Some of that scheme, some of that's also them doing a good job of stepping up to the plate. And then I think that were there any LSU turnovers?
No. There was only the one turnover. Trask's interception was the only turnover in the entire game. It was a clean played game. There weren't a lot of penalties either. It was a very clean, enjoyable game. It was something we don't get a whole lot of.
Florida also number 1 in the country in takeaways. So you don't get the takeaways. You don't get the sacks. LSU scores the points. It's the way it works. Mm-hmm. The team that it struggled to score points, and a team that did not play a very clean game. Let's talk about these Georgia Bulldogs, because we talked on this podcast. We're like, I don't know if this team is really built to be able to blow teams out. I don't know if this team is built to be able to hang with an LSU if it starts to get wild, with an Alabama if you need to score 40 points to win. And sure enough, man, like, this was the worst. I only felt comfortable in the moment saying it was the worst game of 2019 for Jake Fromm. But I think that the post-mortem from Athens has really revealed that it's a consensus opinion. This was the worst game that Jake Fromm's probably had as a starting quarterback. And he's had some games where he wasn't as much of a difference maker, but he was a part of 4 turnovers in this game, including an interception in overtime, including a pick 6, including a crucial lost fumble on a quarterback center exchange. And this offense, I mean, they outgained South Carolina by a dramatic number. Things were just like the miscues and the mistakes compounded on each other. And I look at Georgia, and it kind of feels like if you thought that Georgia was playing with fire with the nature of the way that they operate offensively, then this was the game where it all came in on itself. And I didn't think it was going to be against South Carolina. I thought that this was going to be something that we saw come up against Florida, or something that we saw come up against Auburn or later in the season. But it happens here at home against the Gamecocks. Like, what do we make of the Georgia Bulldogs based on this performance?
I had this feeling or this thought as I was watching the game. If we think back a few weeks ago when Notre Dame went into Athens and played well, and our takeaway from seeing Notre Dame play well against Georgia was, hey, Notre Dame, they might be better than we thought. This is a pretty good team. And I'm now wondering if the takeaway should have been, oh, wow, maybe Georgia's not as good. as we're assuming it is by putting it at number three and in the top five, because I mean, Georgia didn't really play that much differently in this game than it did against Notre Dame a few weeks ago. The problem was, like you said, the four turnovers. And of the three interceptions, I think the one in overtime was not on Fromm. That he hit his receiver in his hands. That should have been caught. But the first two, the pick six was on Fromm, was a throw he shouldn't have made. And the second one was just a bad throw that I hope I'm pronouncing this right, Israel Mukwamu just made a terrific catch on. I mean, he hit all three of the interceptions in this game for South Carolina. He had himself a good day. But it was just, it gets to the heart of the problem with Georgia. If you run they ran 95 plays today, Chip.
Mm-hmm.
95. They outgained South Carolina by nearly 200 yards. South Carolina had 11 penalties for 68 yards.
Oh, and they were down to their third-string quarterback with Ryan Helinski knocked out of the game earlier in the third quarter.
Ryan Helinski gets knocked out. Dakarian Joyner has to come in. And it's not like Joyner comes in off the bench and plays well. He was 6 for 12 for 39 yards.
Did you hear Muschamp say that Joyner hadn't even been practicing all the way during the week because of a hamstring issue?
I could tell.
He couldn't go.
By all accounts, this is a game that South Carolina should not have had any prayer of winning. But Georgia, they had the four turnovers, and ironically enough, South Carolina, the only points they got out of those four turnovers were on the pick six. The other three turnovers, they didn't score off of, including, in the overtime. So this wasn't a situation where South Carolina took advantage of the turnovers as much as those turnovers kept Georgia from scoring the points it should have ended up with to win this game and never be in the position to go to overtime. And then one of the other things that loomed in this for me was something we've also talked about, just some of Kirby Smart's decision making. Just kind of baffling at the end of that game. I mean, there was some questionable timeout usage in the fourth quarter that put Georgia in the spot late in the game where it had no timeouts left. So it's sitting there with the choice of we could kick like a 57 or 58 yard field goal, whatever it would have been, or we could throw the Hail Mary. If you had some timeouts, you probably couldn't have gotten a bit closer and put Rodrigo Blankenship in better position to make the kick. But even so, Rodrigo missed the kick in overtime. But I have more confidence in him given some of the big kicks that he's made for Georgia during his career. I feel like you have a higher probability of him making that long field goal at the end of regulation than you do of converting on a Hail Mary. So I didn't understand why they didn't try to attempt the field goal, because I felt like they had a better chance to win. But Will Muschamp didn't exactly hold himself in the highest esteem either, because I don't know what South Carolina was doing at the end of it. This was a combination of really sloppy play by Georgia and some questionable coaching decisions by Kirby Smart at the end that kind of just put them in positions where they were allowing South Carolina a chance to win the game. And South Carolina, although somewhat reluctantly, it seemed at times, took advantage of it and won the game.
So I've got a bubbling thought from this that this game is really built on. It is that Georgia's offensive line is really, really big. They're all tall. They're all strong. They all weigh a lot of pounds, and a lot of them are probably going to go on to play in the NFL. And so because they are highly touted and talented prospects, we look at all of them together, and we see them just mowing teams down when Georgia's playing its best games. DeAndre Swift running behind them. We're like, wow, this is incredible. But when we have seen now a couple of times this year that Georgia offensive line get overwhelmed. And I just and I wonder if we need to go do that thing that we do with teams sometimes where you say, all right, like, I understand that individually these are all very talented individuals, but as a unit, I don't know if Georgia's offensive line in the 2019 season has become a dominating unit when it comes to playing top competition.
Yeah, I mean, they struggled against Notre Dame. That was one of the bigger surprises from that game, is that Notre Dame's front seven, which is good and talented, but I mean, they were overwhelming them at times. And today, they had South Carolina finished with three sacks and six tackles for loss. Georgia didn't have a single sack in the game. So, I mean, Jake Fromm was under pressure in this game. He wasn't getting a ton of time to make the throws. Georgia's running game only averaged 4 yards per carry. Even if you take out the sacks from that equation, they still only averaged 4.6 yards per carry. And when you think about what Georgia wants to do, what its identity is, it's more than 4.6 yards per carry. And they just weren't able to do that against the Gamecocks today. So This is a Georgia team that I think, frankly, is not as good as we thought. And based on what we saw today with both Georgia and Florida losing, Florida might be better than Georgia this year. Florida might be the favorite to win that division now.
How dare you besmirch Missouri's name like that?
I'm sorry, Mizzou, but I mean, you know, just playing the odds.
So Georgia has Missouri. That game is going to be at home. It's got the Florida game in Jacksonville. Georgia has Texas A&M at home at the end of the season. It plays at Auburn. What do you think Georgia's record is at the end of the season?
It's funny. My Friday Five this week was ranking undefeated teams that had the best chance of finishing with three losses, and I didn't really heavily consider Georgia as one of the five possible teams, but after what I saw today, I mean, like you said, they've got Mizzou left, they've got Florida left, they've got Auburn left, they've got A&M left, and it's not just that they have those four games, they're in back-to-back weeks. Like next week they play Kentucky, and then they go on a bye, and then it's a four-week stretch of Florida, Missouri, at Auburn, A&M. That, you know, like the body blow theory, by the end of that stretch, Georgia could be pretty banged up or in some trouble. Now, I think they're probably going to finish around 10-2, but 9-3 is no longer out of the question. They could lose to Florida, and then they could lose easily on the road to Auburn or maybe even at home to A&M. So I would say 10-2, 9-3.
Right now, would you pick Florida to win the East?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, I would pick Florida to win the cocktail party right now. Things could change, obviously. You know, this is college football and teams look different every single week. But it's just Georgia, even, you know, it killed Vandy. It killed Murray State. It killed Arkansas State. It seemed pretty lackluster against Tennessee. It killed against Notre Dame. It looked great against Tennessee. And then today happened. So I feel like, you know, if it's playing a bad team, Georgia's looked great. If it's playing anybody with half a pulse, it's looked a little, you know, and Florida, just based on what we've seen with its game against Auburn and now tonight against LSU, they seem like they're better equipped for those games than the Bulldogs do to this point.
Before we get on to Red River, quick, Alabama in the SEC on CBS game of the week goes into College Station, takes care of Texas A&M. 47-28 is your final right there. Tua Tagovailoa setting a new school record in the win. It's another big yak day. Ah, yak. As Henry Ruggs, Devonta Smith, Jalen Waddle, Jerry Jeudy, the four horsemen of the Alabama wide receiver room, just turning 10-yard passes into 60-yard gains. It's what they do. It is another day for Alabama to be able to comfortably lean back on one of the best passing attacks in the country as they're able to go on the road against what we properly introduced as the toughest opponent that they had faced so far. I thought that Texas A&M showed up, threw a couple punches early, but it is so, so difficult when Alabama has those kind of counters and those kind of responses with those quick strike touchdowns.
Yeah, you've got to play like a perfect game for the most part if you're A&M to really pull this off. And it's, I think the bigger question though, Chip, is Tua threw an interception today. Andy threw for fewer than 300 yards. So I mean, is he done? Is he washed?
That's it.
Have we seen the beginning of the end for Tua Tagovailoa? I feel like if you're A&M, you're 3-3. Your three losses are now to Alabama, to Clemson, and to Auburn.
What's the third one? It's Auburn.
So it's not like you've got a bad loss on your resume. It's just you have to play perfect, and they play well. And there was a tweet from Matt Hinton earlier today that I thought was perfect, too, as far as summing up Kellen Mond. It's that Kellen Mond, in the course of a game, could look completely helpless while the game is still in question. But then as soon as A&M no longer has a chance to win, he looks amazing. And I feel like that was the case again today, where A&M kind of made that fake comeback in the fourth quarter there to make it look closer. And maybe at least for those who were on A&M in the points think that they might get the cover. But I think that Jimbo still has quite a bit of work to do if he's going to get this program to be in a condition where it can compete with Alabama yet.
Hey, Kellen Mond is just really, really good against varsity difficulty level. You crank it up to Heisman, it's going to get a little bit dicey for him. But as long as he's just playing it in the Best Buy on varsity, he'll be fine.
There was, who was it too? There was one pass he missed in the first half where they were in the red zone where the receiver was absolutely wide open and he threw it no fewer than 5 yards behind him. And I was just like, Mike, that is not the throw you can miss against Alabama if you want to have any prayer of pulling off the upset.
Coming up on the other side, our big takeaways from Big Tex and the Red River coming up next.
If you want to win your fantasy football league, it starts right now. The offseason is the best time to get ahead of the competition. We'll help you win your league on the Fantasy Football Today podcast, part of CBS Sports Podcast Network. Fantasy Football Today has 3 episodes every week following the latest news, giving you early rankings, early sleepers, breakouts, and busts. So if you're a dedicated fantasy football manager, check out the most dedicated podcast, Fantasy Football Today. Download and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and anywhere podcasts are found.
The baseball season is in full swing, which means you need to listen to Fantasy Baseball Today, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network. Join Scott White, Chris Towers, and me, Frank Stample, every weekday as we recap every player from every game. We'll talk waiver wire ads, drops, players to trade for, prospects who could make an impact, and everything in between. Make sure to download and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the Odyssey app, and everywhere else podcasts are found.
So I was very excited because the game got started in Dallas, and the number one thing that I wanted to see after talking to Ben Kercheval this week heading into the game was just Jalen Hurts' big and meaty hindquarters. Because, boy, Oklahoma got going with the power run game early, and Jalen Hurts was doing that thing where he drops back and he recognizes that he's got a whole bunch of green grass and he's going to take off and run. Oklahoma jumps all over Texas, sort of outgains them, but a couple of turnovers allow Texas to be able to hang in this game. It's a game that if you just watched it without paying attention to the score, if you watch this game almost in cut-ups, if I organized them by first, second, and third down, you know, coaching style, prep style, you would think that Oklahoma had dominated in this game, but it was a one-score victory. So, you know, Are you willing to extend some of the same? This was just a big game, a rivalry game, a fun game, a competitive game. Not excuse, but at least the context you're willing to apply to it to the Sooners in a game that they needed to win, obviously, to be able to continue their pursuit of a college football playoff spot. But then also for just being able to prove to everyone that maybe it does belong in that conversation as potentially one of the best teams in the country and a national championship contender. How do you analyze the Sooners' victory with all the context applied?
Well, I think that, yeah, you have to put some of the rivalry glasses on as far as viewing it and the results. But I think that going back to what happened with Georgia and just the style of play, the first half, Oklahoma outgained Texas 260 yards to 83.
That's the numbers. You know, Tom, I needed the numbers. In my head, I knew that it was lopsided. Yeah, those are the numbers.
They outgained them 3-1, over 3-1. Yeah. And it was 10-3 at halftime because Oklahoma turned the ball over 3 times, including twice in the red zone. This was a game that probably should have been 21-3 at halftime, and it wasn't. But because of their style of play, because of their explosiveness on offense, they were able to overcome the turnovers, unlike Georgia, who hasn't really had a chance to do that. So, I mean, I'm not worried about Oklahoma, and I'm not worried about Texas. This was the kind of game that you expected. I was, you know, obviously I had Oklahoma in my column for the pick, so I was hoping they can get that cover, that back door by Texas at the end. That hurt a little bit. But Jalen Hurts did not have a great game. Jalen Hurts, he had the fumble in the red zone. He threw that interception, and while the fumbles happened, that interception was just a bad decision and a bad pass that he paid the price for, but he made up for it. He still threw for 3 touchdowns. He rushed for over 131 yards, and you know, CeeDee Lamb did a lot of work for the Sooners and helped bail out that offense, but he had 10 catches for 171 yards, 3 touchdowns, juked at least 5 dudes out of their shoes. It was just an amazing performance to watch. And to me, the biggest takeaway from this game, Chip,
Sooners defense.
Did you, oh my God, they had 9 sacks and 15 tackles for loss.
Yeah, on my notepad, I had from this game, I said that it was CeeDee Lamb and Oklahoma's defense. And I probably would not have guessed, based on the premise of talking about an Oklahoma win, I would be ready to talk about Jalen Hurts and where does he rank among the greatest quarterbacks in the country. And you're right, that's not what it was. It was CeeDee Lamb being ridiculous and an Oklahoma defense that has absolutely lived up to all the billing of the improvement in terms of being able to get pressure on the quarterback, in terms of rallying to the ball. Like, it's Alex Grinch's name might have been mentioned 25 times on the broadcast because of how well the Sooners defense was playing.
It was a bizarro Saturday because, I mean, LSU and Florida are in a shootout. And meanwhile, earlier in the day in Texas, Oklahoma's defense is having to bail out its offense because the offense keeps screwing up and turning the ball over. So, yeah, no, this I think that is the most promising sign if you're Oklahoma going forward as far as the title hopes are concerned, because I don't think that there's anybody else in the Big 12 outside of maybe Bedlam, because, again, rivalries are rivalries and they can get weird. But I think that if you look, Oklahoma is probably going to roll through the rest of this schedule, barring some, you know, injuries to Jalen Hurts or other key players. But the fact now that that defensive performance, that's something they didn't have last year. That's something they didn't have the year before. That was why you could never really count on them when it came to a huge game. If the offense got into a rut, they were screwed because you didn't think that their defense was capable of stopping anybody. But if the defense plays like it did today against Texas, that's a team that could win a semifinal. That's a team that could win a title game, you know, depending on who it's up against. So it's the kind of complete performance that we've missed from the Sooners in recent years. And it makes this team a lot more dangerous in my eyes going forward.
Baylor is 6-0 after winning in double overtime against Texas Tech. What are the chances that you give Baylor to be in the Big 12 championship game?
They're not horrible. I mean, I still think that we're probably going to see Texas and Oklahoma again. But if you look at the way things set up for Baylor, next week at Oklahoma State, it's going to be tough. But West Virginia looks winnable because Mountaineers don't look great. TCU doesn't look great. And then we're going to have that two-week stretch in mid-November. They're playing Oklahoma. They're playing at Texas. Those are two tough games. But both of those games are in Waco. So if Baylor can get past Oklahoma State next week, it's looking really good, because if you look at Texas's schedule, they're already 2-1 in the conference. They've got some tough games themselves. They've got TCU on the road and Iowa State on the road. And we know, you know, sometimes Texas heads up to Ames and weird things happen. So this is a situation where that game against Baylor on November 23rd between Texas and the Bears is looking like a big game. It could probably end up deciding who gets to play Oklahoma in the Big 12 championship.
So I think I've got my arms around these lovable Bears a little bit more. They're still working to figure things out offensively. And, mm-hmm. You know, you made the comment before about, you know, this is one of those Big Ten teams that just happens to play in the Big 12. But defensively, they're really, really good.
Yeah.
And I'm fascinated to see how it goes when they clash with some of these top teams, because they're where they are offensively at this point in the season on October 13th. Leads me to believe that they probably have, what, 2 losses in them? But who those losses come to are very, very important, and when those losses come are very pivotal. And it makes them almost kind of like a old school Iowa State-y type wild card.
Yeah, like if the 2 losses come to Oklahoma State and Oklahoma, but they beat Texas, well, guess who's the number 2 team in the Big 12 at the end of the season?
Right.
And this game, I mean, it's funny. If you look at the box score, because you see the final score, 33-30.
Nah, that game was...
it was 20-20 after the end of regulation. They added the points on in overtime, but it was like a very ugly game, but not like a rock fight ugly game. It felt like it was 2 defenses that you're not used to seeing be as good as they kind of were, at least today. Like, Texas Tech's defense looks improved over what we are used to seeing. Baylor's defense has been stout all year. There were 6 turnovers in this game. It was an ugly, strange, enjoyable, weird game. It was a butt. B-U-T-T, the butt bowl.
What was the double butt was when it was 3-3 for a long time?
Yeah,
and then if you take the threes forever, and you turn them 90 degrees, it just makes big old butt cheeks. Iowa State 38-14 winners in Morgantown. How many did I got a little bit of eyes on this, but it was mostly when it was still competitive at West Virginia jumped out to an early lead. I think I tried to watch the middle eight of this one. You know, I've been all over that middle eight. And shocker, middle eight was won by the Cyclones. They pull away 17 fourth quarter points, make it 38-14. I liked West Virginia's fight in this game, but once the Iowa State settled down in control, it was kind of over.
Yeah, West Virginia's offense is just not good. They had 190 yards of offense in the game, and it was like they were hanging around in the first half, making it a game, but Iowa State made some adjustments in the second half at halftime, and you know how many yards of offense West Virginia had in the second half, Chip?
I don't.
44.
In a half.
Yeah, in the entire second half. So Iowa State figured out what West Virginia was doing. It made the adjustments it had to coming out in the second half, and that was the end of the game. They just pulled away, and it wasn't even close to the end anymore.
Mm. Hey, so let's turn our attention to the Big Ten.
Okay.
Penn State's still undefeated. They're 17-12 winner at Iowa. Do you come away from it feeling significantly better about Penn State?
No. I mean, I don't feel bad because this was what we were expecting for the most part. This is just kind of what happens when Penn State and Iowa play. It's usually kind of an ugly, you know, boxing match. And this is also a situation where Sean Clifford had, you know, they've played one road game earlier this year. It was against Maryland, and Maryland's not exactly the most, you know, fervorous road environment. Not the scariest, not the loudest place to play. So this was clearly the first like true road test that Clifford has had as the starter. And he kind of played like it. You know, he's 12 for 24, 117 yards and a touchdown. This is an Iowa defense that was very good and has been good all year. It completely shut down Michigan for the most part last week. And very similarly here today. I mean, Iowa outgained Penn State as far as total yardage is concerned. It's just Iowa had two turnovers. And in a game like this, turnovers are going to kill you. But I think this was just the kind of performance that for Penn State, they just have to get through. And that's what they did. But they're still, you know, I think that if you look at the rest of the Big Ten East, they're better than Michigan. We're going to talk about Michigan State soon. They're better than Michigan State. It's just going to be which team shows up for the Ohio State game. And nothing I've seen from Penn State so far leads me to believe that they can compete with Ohio State for full 60 minutes, but they're still the second best team in their division. You know what I mean? There's still a gap there because they've played two above average teams and they have struggled to get past both of them, which seems like a bad omen to me.
So here's what I'm willing to consider with Penn State. I think that because there are so many young players in significant roles, we might be witnessing a team that can continue to get better. That Penn State like could be marching towards being a team that can compete with Ohio State. Now, unfortunately, you know what? Let's see. That game is late October. Are we about 2 weeks away from it?
Which game?
Ohio State, Penn State.
Oh, no. That's November 23rd.
Ooh.
I mean, there's a possibility. I mean, they've got Michigan in Happy Valley next week. Then the week after, they're going to East Lansing. Then they get a bye, and then they're on the road against Minnesota. And, I mean, those are three games I think Penn State's capable of winning, and they should beat Indiana. So there's a situation, or at least a realistic possibility, that, you know, they're rolling into Ohio State where both of them are 10-0 and probably ranked in the top five.
There's a lot of sophomores out there on the field on both sides of the ball, and I feel like especially on defense. And I'm willing to consider that even given what limitations Penn State's offense certainly has shown at times, like whether it's playing in this game or whether it's the Pitt game, like there are times where Penn State's offense is no bueno. But I am willing to consider that that group could continue to improve and that we could catch the Nittany Lions being a very dangerous team at the end of the season. That said, I didn't feel like this win at Iowa checked any boxes for me in terms of me feeling like I was ready to level up the Nittany Lions. But like you mentioned, you won, you know. So
it's really, I think that still was undefeated, honestly,
yeah. And that's
really
good
the
enough.
Only thing they cared about tonight.
Yeah, just win, and everything will be okay.
Also, there was a very questionable call as far as taking a Penn State touchdown off the board in this game. That I think if the refs got that call right, it's probably not as close or as scary as it looks at the final score. You know, then it's probably a 2-score win and it looks a little better. So there is that context as well. But it's just, this is a young team. It's a talented team. Like you said, it's got a chance to get better. But to this point, it's still a team that's, you know, figuring out how to be great.
Wisconsin kicked the ever-loving you-know-what out of Michigan State.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that was a great lock of the week for me, taking Michigan State plus 11 in this one.
38-0 doesn't even do this game justice.
No. Here's what people should... If you didn't watch the game, here's the thing I could tell you that probably tells you everything you need to know. Michigan State did not cross over the 100-yard barrier of total offense until there was 90 seconds remaining in the game.
It could have been 63-0 in this game. Yes. Truly, it was a choose your own number adventure for Wisconsin.
Yeah, and my whole thought process behind my picking Michigan State was, you know, hey, they could take away Wisconsin's run game and force Jack Cohn to beat him. Well, Michigan State, for the most part, took away Wisconsin's run game. The Badgers averaged only 4.8 yards per carry. They held Jonathan Taylor to 80 yards on 26 carries. But you know what happened? Jack Cohn picked him apart. He was 18 for 21 for 180 yards, zero or one touchdown, no interceptions. It wasn't like the big game, because that's just not what Wisconsin does offensively in the passing game. But he just sat in the pocket. Michigan State couldn't get any pressure, and he was just looking for the open matchup, and he was finding it every single time. And Michigan State's defense just could not get off the field, even when they stopped Jonathan Taylor in their running game. They just couldn't get off on third down. They couldn't even really get Wisconsin into a situation on third down that presented any real problems for it. So this, it felt like Wisconsin was like a 16-year-old playing with his 5-year-old brother.
I think that I came away from this one wanting to maybe shift the narrative or the talking points a little bit on Wisconsin, because Jonathan Taylor is a mainstay. He's a name that we recognize, and Wisconsin having good running backs, that's a very easy place for college football fans to fall back into from a muscle memory perspective. But I think the real tale of this year's Wisconsin team is the defense, which kind of lost itself last year for a hot second, and boy, it snapped back into place. And so when we've got that situation, it was Dave Aranda leaves and Jim Leonard takes over, and Jim Leonard has his own player history, but his coaching history wasn't all that proven. Great instant results for Jim Leonard. Then last year, as we mentioned, you know, they finished 7-5. The defense has a bunch of injuries, but also doesn't quite perform up to the standard that we're used to. And I would say that this is a snap back into place. This is a return to form, and maybe even exceeding it even further, to the point where I think that Wisconsin's defense might be the best thing that it has going to try and win a Big Ten title.
They have 4 shutouts in 6 games.
I mean, seriously.
They have, after 6 games, Wisconsin is outscoring its opponents 255-29.
And I almost want to throw out those last 14 points Michigan scored.
Yeah.
That was garbage time.
Yes. I mean, literally, the only team that's really had actual success on offense that made Wisconsin break into a sweat was Northwestern.
And I maintain that was because Wisconsin broke out the spring game playbook for that game. Yes. they were not going to put any exotic blitzes or coverage patterns on tape for that game.
And they get Illinois next week. So there's a very good chance they're going to have 5 shutouts in 7 games by the time we're recording this podcast next Saturday.
Goodness gracious.
Yeah. You want to talk about Illinois, Michigan?
Yeah, I do.
Do we have to?
No. I mean,
Illinois made a run there for a minute.
And what do we make of that run?
That Michigan is got problems.
Oh, see, I was, because I got assigned to Georgia upset duty, which, you know, lasted way longer than it should have and had too many dumb twists and turns and writes and rewrites, I actually didn't see any of Illinois' comeback.
I hesitate calling it a comeback, but yeah, Michigan was up 28-0. They allowed Illinois to score right before halftime, so it was 28-7 at halftime. Then Michigan got sloppy with the ball in the third quarter, turned it over a couple times. Illinois made it. It was 28-17. Illinois got a touchdown early in the fourth quarter and cut it to 28-25. And then as soon as Michigan was in actual trouble, they marched right down the field and scored and went back up by two scores. And then a couple, you know, Illinois, they pinned Illinois, got another turnover, scored, and just the game went out of, you know, back out of touch really quickly. My takeaway from this is that Michigan still has plenty of significant problems, even though it mostly played well. I mean, they averaged 7 yards per play. They had nearly 500 yards of offense. It's just they should have buried Illinois, and they kind of toyed with it, or at least kind of, I don't know, you could say they took their foot off the gas pedal for a bit and were thinking they could coast to the end, and then Illinois made it, you know, start going again. But I don't know. It's even when Michigan was dominating this game early, there still wasn't anything about them that really struck me as a threat. They still look like an above average Big Ten team, but they don't look like a Big Ten team that's going to really do any damage in any games that count.
That's Michigan football, baby.
It has been, yeah.
Wait, I'm sorry. Did y'all want championship contenders? That's not Michigan football. That's not what they do. Michigan puts together very, very underachieving 9-3 seasons.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so let's pivot to Michigan adjacent, Michigan on the horizon. Notre Dame is just really leaning into this idea that our quarterback is not much of a passing threat, but if our offensive line keeps beating you up for 35 carries, we're going to roll up 300 yards.
Yeah. You had more of an eye on this one, but from what I saw, I mean, they look fine. I mean, they can't throw. Book finished with 165 yards. He's only 17 of 32, 165 yards. They still don't really have that threat in the passing game that could be a game breaker. So they're kind of just relying on Tony Jones and Jafar Armstrong only had one carry tonight. I thought he was like back. What was there any story behind that?
No, I think that Jones just got going and they were starting to work in a lot more of like misdirection, end around, getting the wide receivers involved in the game. Like who's Braden? What's his last name? Lindsey?
Oh, that dude is fast.
Yeah.
That's all I know. Yeah.
He's a sophomore from Oregon. And shocker, he's a track star from Oregon. But yeah, like 4.4 speed or something stupid like that. He hit he caught an end around, took it the distance. It was pretty impressive. But this Notre Dame team, like basically what we saw here against USC was the fact that USC on the defensive line is not elite, and they definitely don't have elite depth. So even when USC's defense was able to get some stops early in the game, by the time its offense finally caught a rhythm, which wasn't until the second half, I mean, Keaton Slovis led four straight scoring drives in the second half. It's just that they would score in 3 minutes, and then they'd give the ball back to Notre Dame, and Notre Dame would take up 8 minutes and then score. And so the advantage that was established with the 14-3 lead, they just never really had to push back on it. And they could just kind of defend it, use that ground game to continue to wear USC down. And that was the key over the course of four quarters was you get into the second half against this USC team. They are older. They are experienced. They are strong. They're big. And they lean on you. And I thought about this game looking ahead at the rest of Notre Dame's schedule, and I was just thinking about how there isn't a defensive line or a defensive front left on Notre Dame's schedule that is overly impressive. And there's not a defensive line or a defensive front that I think is going to be able to come up with a magical game plan to just do that, that the physics of the fact that Notre Dame, if nothing else is working, and certainly the passing game with Ian Book has not been something that Brian Kelly or Chip Long feel like is their bread and butter, they're just going to lean on you, man, and the chances are you're going to break eventually.
How'd the front seven look? I know they had four sacks, but, I mean, that doesn't always – because that's, to me, has been the key to this team. I mean, defensively, they've just been a lot better than I was actually anticipating coming into the year.
Difficult to say because they were sitting back doing everything they could to limit the deep ball, mm-hmm. and so it was a lot of dink and dunk. It was a lot of Keaton Slovis drops back. He sees that everyone, all the, you know, secondary is backpedaling, and so he's just going to drop it off to a running back or like throw a quick route to like they were breaking it. Who'd they break in? I feel like hadn't even had too many catches. Eric.
Oh, Crum and Hook or whatever?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, I have no idea how to pronounce it. It's like, it's Eric Crum and Hook.
He had one catch against Fresno State, one catch against BYU, two catches against Notre Dame, five catches against, two catches against Washington, five catches against Notre Dame.
Yeah, so he's like their underneath kind of slot dude now.
Yeah, so I kind of thought that the front seven didn't get – I thought Marquise Stepp, the running back for USC, looked pretty good at times, but it was tough to get a good read on USC considering the fact they were going up against air raid, no huddle, you know?
Yeah. I mean, Notre Dame's on a bye next week, and then they get the road trip to Ann Arbor, and I feel like I have a hard time thinking Michigan's going to win that game based on what we've seen. And after that, I don't know what's in their way from being 11-1 at the end of the year.
Clemson put it on Florida State.
Yeah, Clemson showed up. Welcome to 2019, Clemson.
Yeah, but I don't know. Trevor Lawrence still threw an interception. He probably stinks.
He's still trash.
Yes.
But I wonder if he's okay. Let's make sure somebody asks Dabo about the MRI, see what kind of reaction they get.
So the thing that's really funny about this one is the final score suggests that everything's okay. Clemson's back to whooping that ass. But if you look at the box score of this game, there's no one player you can really single out, and there's no one thing where you're like, wait, did Clemson dominate in this game? Like, where's my 400 yards passing? Where's my, mm-hmm. you know, like big rushing total? It's because Clemson's defense was awesome in this game. They forced a ton of turnovers, and players like Isaiah Simmons really showed up. The young defensive line was really feasting on a Florida offensive line that has struggled a lot during the season. But that's the one place where I think that you've got the greatest chance for we talk about Penn State and the growth and trying to predict and project that might be a better team at the end of the season than it is right now. The Clemson defense is where you look at that group and those players and you think, okay, so these are guys that, I mean, they are in new positions. The positions that they are occupying were occupied by the same veterans for 3 or 4 years. Christian Wilkins played damn near every single down from the moment he set foot on campus. Same with Dexter Lawrence. Like, did not take long for Cleland Farrell to... He was a little bit banged up at the beginning of his career, but point being, the players who were there on the starting defense and the defensive front, they are... just now starting to have the first time in their career where it's like, okay, I've gotten significant action in six straight games. And I think that the growth and improvement that they have right now, between now and the end of the season and from the end of the regular season into the playoff, if they make it to the playoff, those are going to be the players that I think determine whether or not Clemson wins a national championship. And I thought that Clemson defense, even though, again, the final score suggests it was a Trevor's okay. Oh, no, Trevor's okay, man. You know, T's all right. He just had a little hamstring, got a little tied up on him. But, you know, he's okay. Justin's good. You know, but I thought that the story of this was Isaiah Simmons and just the rest of those young defensive playmakers that are just shining and will continue to as the season goes on.
Yeah, if you're listening to this, do yourself a favor. As long as you're not driving, but if you're like at home or around a computer, just pause right now and go look at the Florida State side of the box score and just look at how sad it looks. Like Blackman had 66 yards passing, Hornibrook had 84. Nobody broke 100 yards in anything for Florida State.
Yeah. Nobody broke 100 yards in anything. That should tell you everything you need to know.
It is a very, very sad looking box score. Although, like you said, offensively, if you go to the other side, I mean, Travis Etienne had 127 yards rushing, so that was nice to see for Clemson, but it was mostly a pedestrian performance from that offense too. They were put in a lot of short field situations thanks to that defense.
Virginia lost to Miami. What else is on your notepad before we get out of here?
Do we want to address the most fraudulent undefeated team in the country?
The Minnesota Golden Gophers?
Yeah. They're still undefeated, but for the second week in a row, they have looked dominant. They looked dominant against Illinois in a 40-17 win last week, and they looked especially dominant tonight against Nebraska. But the problem is, it's like you don't know how seriously to take it because, you know, Adrian Martinez didn't play. Noah Vedral was making his first start for the Cornhuskers, and their run defense has been bad all season, and Minnesota took advantage of that tonight. Boy, they rushed for 322 yards against that Huskers defense. So,
isn't it still Rodney Smith and Ibrahim?
It's Rodney Smith. Ibrahim had 84 yards. They had three players with over 80 yards rushing. Ibrahim had 84 yards and three touchdowns. Shannon Brooks had 99 yards. Rodney Smith had 139 yards and a touchdown. This is a Minnesota team that when I call it fraudulent, I want to be clear. I'm not saying it's bad. It's playing its schedule, and it's taking advantage of its schedule. And as I wrote in my Friday Five, this is a team that is probably going to be 8-0 at the end of October. It's just when November comes, so cometh the reckoning, because they're going to have to play Penn State, Northwestern, Iowa, and Wisconsin. But enjoy it for now, because, hey, maybe you keep getting better. Maybe you pull off an upset somewhere along the way, and what do you know? Somehow you end up winning the Big Ten West. I don't think it's going to happen. But this is a Minnesota team that's suddenly looking like a team that could definitely finish in second place in the West, especially, you know, if it knocks off Iowa. It looks like a team that's at least capable of doing that. So kudos to Minnesota. I know I've been knocking you all year long, but you're kind of, you know, you're sticking it in my face a little bit every week.
I told Eric Kay today that I'm just the clown in the dunking booth, and Bowling Green finally hit the target.
That was an unexpected. Well, Toledo, for those of you who are unaware, was a 27-point favorite against Bowling Green today, and there were only 27 points scored in the game, and Bowling Green had 20 of them.
Yeah, you thought that Georgia losing at home as a 24-point favorite was the most unexpected result. No, it might have been Toledo is a 26-point favorite losing to Bowling Green, a team that was averaging 300 less yards per game than its opponents.
Yes.
So now I get to sweat out my Bowling Green season-long under of 3 wins for the rest of the season, as they are 2-4 midway through the year.
Yeah, also special shout-outs to Maryland, who went on the road and lost to a half-dead Purdue team by 26. And let's not look past Vandy, who lost to UNLV by 24 points at home in the bottom 25 game of the century of the week.
Louisville won 62-59. That's a regulation score from Winston-Salem.
That was on ACC Network. So
tree falls in the woods. Tom didn't see it.
I couldn't see it, but man, that looks like cocaine. This game looks nuts.
Tennessee beaten Mississippi State 20-10 at home. I think that's
go Vols.
Yeah, go Vols. That was a like I would not
that dude can come off the roof.
I would not say that is a false hope win, but I do think that was maybe like a feel better present. Mm-hmm. You go to the doctor, you know, it was kind of scary, but you survived it. You were a big kid. You get something cheap from the drugstore while you wait to pick up your prescription. Feel better present.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's, I mean, I think Mississippi State's got some problems, but, you know, Tennessee's had plenty of problems of its own, and it took advantage of an opponent with problems, which is the problem that Tennessee has had a lot of in recent years, not being able to do that. So that's a good win for them. Also, shout out to your money line sprinkle.
Mm-hmm. Temple.
Temple. Yeah, Temple getting it done on the field. Just, yeah, it wasn't, outside of the Georgia loss, it wasn't like a crazy Saturday. There wasn't a ton of crazy things going on, but it was an interesting Saturday. One thing I can't help but notice is, you know, Army lost again today.
Yeah.
17-8 to Western Kentucky. I don't know what's going on there. Army Navy's suddenly getting a little more questionable going forward. I don't know what's going to happen in that game. Oh, and apologies. Sorry, Barton, but your Beavers, not quite back yet.
They got run by Utah.
Uh-huh. 52-7.
Oh, jeez.
And it was, I mean, that touchdown, Oregon State's touchdown did not come early in the game. It was already 52-0 before the Beavers got on the scoreboard.
Goodness gracious. Yes. Temple 5-1, only loss at Buffalo.
Mm-hmm. Which is a weird loss.
It's a very strange loss, but they'll be putting it to the test. They are at SMU next weekend on Saturday. That's a pretty fun bit of action for our beloved Hoot Hoot Owls. Now 5-1, the Fighting Anthony Russos.
AAC is going to be fun to watch down the final month and a half here, because there's a few teams in that conference that are fully capable of winning it still.
No doubt. Anything else? Any other shout outs we want to throw?
Shout out to Barton. Miss you.
Miss you, bud.
Hope you enjoyed the wedding. Prove to us that you listened. Send us a text that said the Beavers are not back as soon as you hear this.
Oh, no. Send us a text of your sister in Australia listening to this, finding out that you're not on it.
That's a good call. She'll be hearing this in about 20 minutes.
Yeah, y'all think whoever listens to this podcast on Sunday morning while they're doing their morning chores or just sort of whatever you do with your Sunday morning, you thought you were the first one to get it. No. We're international, baby.
They're listening to this in Australia at 1 a.m. Eastern.
Just enjoying the afternoon listening to the Cover 3 podcast.
Mm-hmm.
For sure. That's Tom Fornelli. You can follow him on Twitter at Tom Fornelli. You can follow me at Chip_Patterson. Tom, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hello, everyone. It's Mike Richards here. You might have seen me on CBS working on their Champions League coverage over the last couple of years. I wanted to tell you about an exciting new podcast that I've been working on. It's called The Rest Is Football. It's me, alongside Gary Lineker and Alan Shearer, two absolute legends of the game. The show combines topical debate from the world of soccer along with outrageous tales from our careers. And I mean outrageous. Just search The Rest Is Football wherever you get your podcasts. All the best from Big Meats.